Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support the community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. We got a jam-packed show today. There's been a lot going on this week, and we got two callers calling in. One at 11:15 from Bloomington Normal about a tar sands pipeline that's going to go through McLean County and all sorts of resistance to it, and also a story about how this Enbridge Corporation with the pipeline is basically really starting to try to bully local elected officials and residents alike. And then 11:30, we got a caller calling in from Tacoma, Washington, talking about a ballot initiative that they got on the ballot to basically raise minimum wage to $15 an hour, and actually how they've been getting resistance from the National 15 Now campaign. So I'm kind of looking forward to that story, too. Excuse me. I got some quick public service announcements I want to get in here before I forget them, because we got so much going on. We're probably going to go a little into overtime today, into the Union Edge. But anyway, just let everybody know that the threat from toxic dumping is not over. It was a community meeting on the Mahomet Aquifer for Saturday, September 19th, 2015, from 10:30 to 12:30 at the Champaign Public Library, 200 West Green Street, Champaign. And that's Saturday, September 19th, 10:30 to 12:30 at Champaign Public Library. We'll keep you updated on that. And also the second annual immigrant welcome awards are going to be September 12th, Saturday, September 12th, from 3 to 4:30 at Crystal Lake Boathouse in Urbana. And last but not least, Labor's Worldview TV this Sunday and every Sunday on Comcast Channel 6 and UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. Part 3 of Stanley Krenauer's Vietnam Television History, the uncensored version. So tune in for that. So anyway, we'll start with Gus, I guess. What's going on? There's a lot going on. So what do you want? Yeah, you know, talk about first here.
Despite the Trump media storm that's been going on, just clogging up the airwaves. Everybody that loves to hear that guy just say whatever that's on his mind. There's really been some really startling economic news going on in the country and also globally right now. Mass layoffs, both internationally and locally, that are really going to affect a lot of what goes on in Illinois. So what's happening actually is that major transnational corporations like Kraft, Motorola, Lenovo, Tyson, and HTC have announced that they're going to have these mass layoffs in the past recent days amid a boom in mergers and acquisitions. Processed food maker Kraft Heinz Company said Wednesday that it would cut 2,500 jobs in North America, amounting to 5% of its global workforce. The announcement is the result of last month's $49 billion merger between Kraft and H.J. Heinz Company in a deal orchestrated by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. The announcement layoff will include 700 at the company's headquarters in Northfield, Illinois, near Chicago. Thousands more layoffs are expected as a result of this major merger deal. So as the company said, it was confident, in quotations, that it would meet this estimated cost savings from the merger of $1.5 billion through 2017. And we all know what that means when they say that they're going to have cost savings.
Yes.
You know, yeah, yeah. People are going to lose their jobs and there's going to be mass layoffs and there's going to be a lot of economic downturn. Also too, I mean, just so many different companies right now are having these massive layoffs. The smartphone maker HTC announced that it's slashing 2,250 jobs or 15% of its global workforce. Again, these are stories that you're not seeing in the news, that there are these massive layoffs going on. And in a local story going into layoffs, the Chicago Public Schools right now are getting hit really hard. Last Monday, they released their 2015-2016 budget, and it includes a $200 million spending cut and 479 additional teacher layoffs in June. So we're talking about 1,400 people that are going to be laid off from Chicago public school system. And we're talking about a federal and state government that has been continuously attacking the Chicago public school system for over a decade now. I mean, it goes longer than that, but we're talking about they have been actually targeting them, closing schools, taking money, and laying off teachers. I mean, mm-hmm. this school system is in dire, dire straits right now, and mm-hmm. it's only getting worse.
Yeah. Continuing on local news about jobs going away. A couple of weeks ago, Mitsubishi announced that they were closing the plant up there in Bloomington Normal, especially with our caller calling in from Normal today. 1,200 workers up there are apt to lose their jobs. Kyle Hamm is heading up an effort to find a new buyer for the Mitsubishi plant. He's a chairperson for the Mitsubishi Task Force, and their goal is to find jobs for these workers, or essentially they're hoping to find another automaker to move in there. He says he calls the workforce at Mitsubishi highly skilled and says that makes them an asset to another automaker that might buy the plant. He says there's a lot of robotics out there, computer works and running the machines, so it's a very, very skilled workforce, he says. So they're hoping another automaker moves in there. But a second part to that story that's just coming out this week is that back in 2011, under then-Governor Pat Quinn, the auto plant and the state agreed to an incentive package worth $29 million over 10 years. The company agreed to spend $45 million in plant upgrades and pledged to keep a workforce of 1,200 employees working there for that 10 years. The conversion of the assembly line to build the Outlander sport utility vehicle was seen as a savior for the plant. Now, this turns out that the state had just given Mitsubishi $3 million about a month before Mitsubishi announced the closing of the plant. Now the state is going to try and find ways to see if they can draw back any of the $9 million that they've already given Mitsubishi since Mitsubishi is closing that plant. But really interesting stuff about how the state can just give that money away to these people. And then, you know, the
Mitsubishi, I think that's a good case for eminent domain. I think they should just seize that plant, and maybe it won't. I mean, granted, they can't start up their own auto company, but the thing is they took Mitsubishi took that money and then reneged on the deal. I mean, I think they need to seize their assets until they pay up.
I mean, they agreed to keep 1,200 workers working there for 10 years, and they're leaving after three, you know, and they've already got $9 million of taxpayer money, you know. We could make a car. We'll call it the Illy car.
The Illy car.
You know, like Yugo in Yugoslavia. They made the Yugo for a while, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And, a Kraft, Champaign, the city of Champaign gave Kraft, I don't know how many millions of dollars here just last year we were talking about.
That district up there, which takes money away from schools every time they do that.
Yep, indeed. And the thing is that they have no conditions on this money they give them. I mean, I could see if they gave them they're into the deal. Kraft would have to hire no worker under $15 an hour, have health insurance, and, if not a pension plan, then a substantial 401k, but no kind of strings attached, no conditions. Here's the money. Here you go. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. I mean, and they gave, I don't know how many millions to this Hyatt Hotel downtown here in Champaign. I mean, as if Hyatt was going to move here to Champaign and then open a hotel anyway, you know, because of all the, you know, events going on here in Champaign-Urbana. I mean, these corporate subsidies, and they play one community off against another, one state off against another. I mean, it just sickens me, you know.
The state of New York gives businesses 10 years tax-free up there to get them to move in.
Okay, let's see who's calling in here. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Dave, and I'm standing here at the farmer's market in Bloomington, Illinois, with a group of concerned citizens, and I'm looking at some signs. One sign says, stop Enbridge now, and Enbridge sues road commissioner, and there's another one that says, don't sue David, for doing his job. I substituted David for the person's name because I don't know if we should use it.
Okay.
But this is a David Goliath story, so I hope that's okay.
Yeah, so could you give a little background to the listeners? What's going on?
Absolutely. We're talking to people about a foreign corporation that's bullying, I call it virtual strong-arming, landowners and a local elected official. Now, there are lots of facets to this story that are just, I call them horror stories, but I'd like to talk about two, if that's okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. The company Enbridge is building an oil pipeline through Old Town Township in McLean County. It starts in Pontiac and ends in Patoka. Now, according to Enbridge documents, they requested permits from David, the Township Road Commissioner, so that they could put the pipeline under his roads. And David's a nice guy. He said, sure, I'll do that. But I just want you to protect my roads. They're little narrow roads. They're hilly. They're chips and oil, not like in a big city. And he has weight limits on them. Well, here's what Enbridge did when he requested those stipulations on the road permit. They said, we're going to sue you. And they did. And I have the lawsuit, and it would be funny if it weren't so serious. It's just a huge lawsuit. Well, it turns out that David really is a David in the David Goliath story because he held his ground, and it turns out that Enbridge capitulated. They added his restrictions. They said, we're not going to destroy your roads and so forth. So he issued the permit. But guess what? Enbridge has not dropped the lawsuit. As a matter of fact, now they're demanding that David signed a new agreement, and if he's willing to do that, they'll drop the lawsuit. And guess what the new agreement says? It says that David or the township can't sue Enbridge in the future. So it's a protection for them. So here's our ask. Here's what we were asking people to do. We're asking them to call local officials. If they're in McLean County, call the county board members. If they're in the state of Illinois, call Lisa Madigan. Call any elected officials that you can with a very simple message: stop the Old Town Township lawsuit.
And this is a tar sands pipeline, basically, and it's none of this or very little of this oil is going to be actually consumed in the United States. It's all going to be exported. Is that correct?
Of course, Enbridge tells you that it's oil that's coming from the Bakken and it's for Illinois use, but I've read over and over and over that the pipeline is licensed for both heavy crude and light crude. So, yes, you've got it right. There's another line that's being built out of Patoka. They're actually reversing a gas pipeline down there, and it's a huge pipeline that's going to go on right down to Port Arthur, Texas, and we know what happens when it gets in Port Arthur, Texas.
Oh, indeed, indeed.
Patoka is the end of the Keystone Pipeline, right? Not the Keystone XL, but the Keystone Pipeline, and that ends in Patoka, Illinois?
You know what you're talking about. There is one that's been there for a while. It's a Keystone that runs from northwest to southeast. Now, there's another side of the story, if I have time.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, the second issue deals with the landowners. And this foreign company, your listeners are probably aware of eminent domain.
Yes.
And what it says is a foreign company can come in and take your right-of-way, but you have a right to a fair settlement. And you can take that fair settlement to a court and have a court decide if you want. They have to do that before they start construction. And, of course, that's the power the landowner has. Well, there's this crazy judge in McLean County that issued something called a quick take order. Now, that's kind of hard to understand, but I'll explain it. Quick as in fast and take as in I'm taking your land. Now, here's what that does. The judge used some obscure part of Illinois law to do that. It's a quick take section of the eminent domain law, and there's a lot of people that think he did it illegally. It was designed for like municipalities and mm-hmm. things like that, and it's never been applied. It's never been applied in Illinois like this. What it means is if the suit stands up. Oh, by the way, it's on appeal right now at the fourth District Appellate Court. If it stands, that essentially means that a pipeline company can come into your land in Illinois, start construction, complete construction on the pipeline, you're still allowed to go ahead and negotiate a deal, and you're even allowed to take it to court. But guess how much power you have after the pipeline's done?
Oh, indeed, indeed. Unbelievable. Indeed. Unbelievable.
So we're asking, again, a very simple ask. We're asking people to call elected officials statewide if they want. McLean County, this is actually in the Fourth Circuit in Peoria, and we're saying stop quick take. And if you call Lisa Madigan's office and she doesn't know, or the person that answers doesn't know what quick take is, tell them they need to learn, because it's a huge issue in Illinois. And we think it's probably going to carry on to other states.
Yeah, I would say that judge is not crazy in McLean County. It sounds to me like he was paid off. I mean, there was another explanation of that. And, you know, I remember there was a Supreme Court case about 10, 15 years ago that set the precedent for the first time that allowed corporations to use eminent domain to take land they want. Prior to that, it was only used by local, state, national governments.
Yeah, private company. And this is even worse because it's a foreign company.
Yes, yes.
We've been talking to people here all morning, and I haven't found one person. We talked to a Tea Partier. We talked to everybody, and there isn't one person that doesn't think this is absolutely horrible. They just go crazy when they hear about it.
So you've been getting a good response over there today at the farmer's market.
Absolutely.
Good, good.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, we want to get you back on the air here coming up in about 3 or 4 weeks to talk more about this in detail. So we only got a few minutes left. What would you like to leave with the listeners today?
I would say just call your local officials, your state officials, with two messages. Stop the Old Town Township lawsuit and stop quick take. Very important issue.
Okay, well, thank you.
We need to stop these bullies.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling in today.
Well, I really appreciate it.
And we'll have you on the air, hopefully with some other people too, coming up here in about 3 or 4 weeks. I'm sure there'll be a lot of more interesting news at that time, and we can, talk about this more in length.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you very much. This is unbelievable.
Yes.
I mean, when I saw that, I read it in the New York Times about 10, 15 years ago. It happened in Connecticut, I believe, when the Supreme Court allowed this lawsuit to this corporation that basically,
They wanted to build a shopping mall
along this river in, I can't remember if it was Hartford or wherever, where the local residents said, no, we don't want to sell our homes, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, for a shopping mall, and I knew then that this was going to open the floodgates. And sure enough, I mean, this is not even a U.S. corporation. It's a foreign corporation that's doing this, and I mean, this is crazy about how, a local judge will allow them to go ahead and build a pipeline, even though it's in the courts to challenge it and everything. I mean, this is ridiculous.
This is one of your major complaints, all of our major complaints about the TPP.
Yep, yep.
About corporations being able to sue states and whatnot if they feel that there's potentially lost profits.
Yeah.
Potential lost profits.
I mean, you got to always ask your question, whose benefit is this? Well, it's not the people, of course. I mean, it's for these multinational corporations, who are buying off our politicians. Same old story, unfortunately, But Gus, about that Chicago Teachers Union thing, I see here that they want them to take a 7% pay cut.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. This article I was reading that says that the Chicago Teachers Union says that Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and Democratic Mayor Mayor Rahm Emanuel are united in a public campaign to convince the public that imposing these draconian budget cuts on our schools and communities is their only option. And the union says the school system is broke on purpose and asserts that revenues and democratic governance are the solutions to education budget woes. I saw a recent new Labor Beat DVD that was just released saying a crisis of its own making, basically saying about how these are manufactured crises in order to privatize, in order to give basically various types of kickbacks to various Chicago, wealthy individuals and corporations, including Penny Pritzker, who's the
Commerce Secretary.
Yeah, now she's a Commerce Secretary. I guess she's the Hyatt Hair, Hyatt Hotels. Yeah. They got a whole bunch of money back a few years ago, and there's all sorts of. This stuff should be illegal.
Paul Muth frequently brings up how the Pritzker family has some grandfathered clauses in that they're allowed to exchange money and stuff like that, with nobody else can do in this country, but they got some kind of a thing grandfathered in.
Exchange money? What do you mean?
Well, if it's foreign exchange things or something like that, yeah. We should talk to Paul about that sometime.
That's okay. Weird. Well, guess what else is going on? Founders, I mean, there's a lot going on this week.
There's a lot, yeah. We've been doing this kind of every other week thing with the UAW. Everybody knows that the United Auto Workers are currently in contract negotiations, and they're not doing too well right now. The U.S. automakers, they recorded very huge profits for the United Auto Workers this past year. But the problem is that they're ruling out any type of significant wage or benefit push in their contract negotiations, which is utterly bizarre. Like, they're not actually, they're making profit. They're making, the car industry is making money right now, but of course the UAW president, Dennis Williams, is just refusing to push for better conditions and better pay for his members. It doesn't make any sense. Recent remarks by UAW officials again make it clear the union is preparing a sellout tailored to the needs of the auto companies and the Obama administration's policy of lowering wage and benefits levels in the United States. The contract covering 139,000 auto workers at Detroit-based car makers expires on September 14. There is a fighting spirit among the auto workers who are demanding an end to the hated two-tier wage system that pays workers hired after 2007 little more than one-half the wages of senior workers. Sentiment is also strong for a significant wage increase and the restoration of cost of living adjustments for traditional workers who have not had a raise in a decade.
Yes, yes.
The determination of auto workers to recruit past concessions is reinforced by the fact that both Ford and GM beat expectations, recording profit margins in excess of 10% in the second quarter of this year. Meanwhile, Chrysler boasted a much improved 7.7% rate increase. The average profit margin in the global auto industry is only 3%. So they're making tons of money. So listen to this though. Responding to reporters' questions about this booming earnings report that everybody's getting, the vice president of the UAW for Ford, Jimmy Settle, said, "We negotiate smart. We don't negotiate for today. We negotiate for the future. We are not negotiating to try to put anybody out of business."
And this came from a union representative.
This is a union member who was speaking about not hurting the profits of big business corporations and capitalists. It is the most bizarre Twilight Zone scenario I've ever seen in terms of a union. But again, we have to look at this from a historical context.
Indeed.
We have to look at it. We have to understand that because of the way unions are constructed in America versus other spaces like South Africa or other places, putting the worker first is not always the mentality of the leadership of the union.
That's right.
There needs to be a mandate that I cannot take anything to negotiations unless it comes from the workers only. If I go outside the workers' mandate, I must be removed from my position as an officer. That's the only way that the membership of unions or workers in this country are going to be able to progress at all.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, we need to get Mike Griffin in here, the guy who called in last week. He's been following the UAW for many years, has nothing good to say about the leadership. He's helped a couple of UAW locals that have fought the national union leadership, and it's been a history. I mean, the UAW was a very strong democratic militant union back in the 30s and 40s. In fact, Walter Reuther, right after the Second World War, when the contract negotiations came up with all the automakers, basically made a proposal that GM, that all automakers had to open their books, and that basically they would be allowed to make a modest profit, pay the workers more, and reduce the price of a car to consumers. But boy, they really balked on that one. But no, it seems like for the last 20 or more years, this has been the pattern for the UAW. And it's really sad. But Mike Griffin could tell you the whole story, including that whole bailout that happened with General Motors. Yeah. I mean, what a sham.
Yeah.
What a sham. I mean, when they had congressional hearings on this, Ralph Nader asked the Obama point person on this if this included the just General Motors U.S. all their assets and stuff. They're claiming that they're going into bankruptcy, or General Motors International. And he didn't, he said he didn't know the answer to that question.
Wow.
Yeah. So obviously what it was a big sham to get a big bailout. And then, of course, it was done on the backs of the workers. Same management was left in place, same structure that got them into the so-called the mess in the first place, you know? And, you know, yeah. So
I just don't really understand at this point how we can distinguish Republicans and Democrats. With these,
it's getting harder and harder to distinguish.
These types of negotiations and these policies, I mean, they're actually backing these things.
Yeah.
I mean, they're pretty much the exact same entity at this point.
Yeah.
We have to make sure that we address the people, our listeners, and anybody that that wants to follow this primary and then also the national election, as there is no differentiation what each person's message is outside of something in terms of birth control or something else. Other than that, they're the same.
Just like what David had said in the Chicago teacher story. Bronner and Emmanuel had joined forces.
Yeah, holding hands, forces.
Yes. You know, Democrats and Republicans.
Both
screwing the workers.
Yeah, it's basically because we live, the reality is we don't live in a democracy, we live in a corporate state. And that's the thing we gotta fight, and fight it every day. And, you know, it's interesting, I just saw that the National Nurses Union just endorsed Bernie Sanders, for president. And, that's something that most national unions don't do that in the primary. Unfortunately, Gus's union, the AFT, Randy Weingartner endorsed Hillary Clinton. You said the National AFL-CIO did as well, right? Yeah, I didn't know about that.
They've already, which is very surprising that they're already endorsing candidates in the primary.
Yeah.
I didn't know they did that early.
That's not usually what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
what I'm trying to understand. Yeah. But I know that Hillary came out earlier. I believe it was a couple of months ago, saying that she was going to be very good to teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the endorsement was a response to that, mm-hmm. which again, we all know that the Clintons in their past have been known to not only bend the truth, but to flat out break it and throw it into the river somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, the Clintons are liars.
I've got another analogy, but I can't say it on the air.
I had to catch myself just now.
Yeah.
But like I said, you know, I don't know at what point that we're going to really understand. And again, these things are out there in the media that Hillary Clinton has been telling fake false truths and lies, but yet nobody is really like calling her out on them when she goes to speak. Right now, I think she just arrived at the Iowa Fair or something today.
Oh, okay.
It's like this big breaking news story like that. I want to see some local groups go into where she's speaking and ask her legitimate questions about issues that we care about as the people.
Mm-hmm.
Not what she wants to just tell us about what she plans on doing.
Yes.
What are you going to do? Here's what we care about. And then call her out on her contradictory messages, because that's all she and the Democrats and Republicans, that's all they do.
That's right. We're going to take a quick music break. I'm hoping our caller will call in here from Tacoma pretty soon. If not, we do have a lot to talk about nevertheless. So you're listening to the World Labor Hour on Lucifer Community Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Sarah Morkin from Tacoma, from 15 Now Tacoma.
Okay, hi, Sarah. Thanks for calling in today and everything. You know, I wanted you to call in because I heard from a mutual friend of ours about your campaign out there in Tacoma. Could you talk a little, give a little background on it for the listeners?
Yeah, we have an initiative, a ballot initiative, that will voters can vote on this November to raise the minimum wage in Tacoma to $15 an hour for the large businesses. The small businesses will be exempt. They'll still have to pay our state minimum wage.
Okay, and what's the definition of a small business? Number of employees.
Yeah. The definition is any business that grosses $300,000 a year or less.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we picked that qualification is that's how they define a small business in our city's tax code.
Okay.
Those businesses get a break on their business and occupations tax. mm-hmm. and they would also not have to pay the $15 an hour minimum wage.
Okay. And what's your state minimum wage?
$9.47 an hour.
Okay. Wow, that's going to be quite a differential there. So this is actually a binding ballot initiative, is that correct?
Yes.
And
enforcement and everything.
Okay, and that's going to be on the ballot coming up in November? Or?
Yes.
Okay. And so you guys have been doing a lot of door-to-door work, I guess, getting signatures for this over time here, I don't know, months or how?
Yeah, we had to collect a certain number of signatures to get it on the ballot. We started collecting the signatures. This has been a long process. We started collecting the signatures in December.
Mm-hmm.
And then we submitted our final signatures in July, I believe,
mm-hmm.
or it might have been June. And then since then, our focus of our campaign has been mainly on doorbelling to make sure that everyone knows about the initiative. And what's really interesting is right around the time we submitted our signatures to get on the ballot, the Chamber of Commerce said to our mayor, "Mayor, this minimum wage initiative, this 15 now, it's going to destroy our economy. You need to do something about this." And we had already gone to the city council and to the mayor back in October of last year to say that we needed a $15 an hour minimum wage in Tacoma, and we mobilized a bunch of people there to speak in favor of that, and nothing came of that.
Huh.
And the Chamber of Commerce wrote one letter, and immediately the mayor formed a task force on the minimum wage, and the task force met for 2 months, and they came up with, they ended up actually coming up with two proposals, and the mayor ended up going with the minority proposal, which was $12 an hour phased in over 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and they put that on the ballot as well. So there's going to be two initiatives on the ballot. Ours will be initiative one to raise the minimum wage to 15 for the large businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And theirs will be initiative 1B to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour over 2 years for all businesses.
Well, that's got to be, unprecedented having, two ballot initiatives to vote on, that basically deal with the same thing, as you mentioned, a 1A and a 1B.
Yeah, ours will be one and theirs will be 1B.
Oh, I'm sorry, yours is one and theirs is 1B, okay.
Yeah.
I never heard of this happening. Now, I understand that you had some other opposition from an unlikely source.
Yes, we did.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Some of the union leadership recommended that we pull the initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about a month or maybe a little bit more before the mayor decided to create a task force. And, you know, if we had followed their request, the request of these union leaders, if we had followed their request and pulled the initiative, then, you know, this $12 an hour initiative that the mayor put on the ballot, that's sort of, even though it's confusing, it's very frustrating, it's a minor victory for us.
Indeed.
That happened, and we got a lot of publicity out of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were like front center in the media when that happened. That would not have happened if it hadn't have been for us, and if we had followed the advice of those union leaders. So,
which union leaders, I mean, I don't want to know their names, but which unions did they, were the ones that asked you not to do the ballot initiative?
UFCW 21 and SEIU 775.
SEIU, United Food and Commercial Workers. Oh, wow. You know, this is crazy. We were just talking about this before you called in. You know, you'd think that these guys being union leaders, that they would be not only supporting you morally, but actually putting some resources to help you get this done instead of fighting you.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, but you've been getting some good responses from people you've been knocking on doors and talking to?
Yes. The most of the people that we've been talking to have been saying that they're going to vote yes on this.
Okay, good.
And there's also been a lot of people undecided. About 15% of the people we've spoken to said no.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to vote no.
Yeah.
So there's, I think that we have a good chance. We have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of doorbells to ring. And I'm at a doorbelling event, and we had a really great turnout of people to come volunteer today.
Good, good. Now, has there been other pushback? I mean, has the Chamber of Commerce or other entities, corporate entities, started running some negative campaign ads? I mean, some negative ads, or do you expect them to do that as the election draws near in November?
They did put out two glossy posters. They mailed them out, but I don't think they really had that much of an impact.
Good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they were the kind of posters that I think they were hoping, like, businesses and stuff would put them up in the window,
mm-hmm.
and I've only seen one, and that was in the window of the Chamber of Commerce.
Okay, well, that's encouraging. I tell you what, then, I definitely want to do a follow-up with you after the November elections, and I'm hoping it's going to be some good news, but even if it's not, for whatever reason, I think people need to learn from your experience and stuff, because it sounds like we need people around the country need to do more of this sort of thing. We had a ballot initiative here in the state of Illinois that passed about raising the minimum wage to $10 and it was not quite $11, but the thing is, it was non-binding. And I made all these inquiries to try to find out who was behind this and why they did a non-binding instead of a binding, and I couldn't find out who it was. I mean, it's almost like they were trying to keep it a secret or something, you know, and I suspect it was probably some of the same forces that you dealt with that were just trying to maybe, run a test balloon or maybe put a little pressure on their Democratic Party friends or whatever, but, it passed by a pretty good margin, but it had no enforcement provisions. And I was glad to hear about you guys' effort to actually put something on the ballot that actually was going to be made law if it passes. We got a few more minutes here. What else would you like to mention to our listeners today that are listening across the country?
Well, the reason that the unions asked us, and not all the unions, we've gotten really good support from our labor council a bunch of AFSCME locals.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that UFCW and SEIU asked us to pull the initiative was they said that we weren't going to win. They weren't going to support us because we didn't have enough support.
And that sounds like...
We weren't going to win, and we were going to... basically cast a bad shadow on this movement of raising the minimum wage.
Really? That's kind of a stretch of logic, but okay.
And, win or lose, this is a fight worth winning. It costs at least $15 an hour in Tacoma to pay rent,
mm-hmm.
to sustain yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe that this, if unions support this, which we hope we still hope that they'll come around.
Mm-hmm.
And, that will build enough momentum that they'll see that they really, they should support this. It's going to show people that unions are fighting for everyone and not just for their own members. And many members, I should say, don't make $15 an hour, even in my own union. People need to see that the unions are relevant to all working people.
I think it's a great statement. And unfortunately, though, I think that's part of the problem right there in a nutshell, the fact that many of these unions have these low-wage contracts that if there's a $15 an hour you know, law passed, that it's going to make them, you know, well, null and void, not only the contract be null and void, but it's going to make them look bad, you know. And yeah, it shouldn't. I mean, they should be out in the forefront of this, like you said. But, yeah, I'm afraid that's part of what it is. But, listen, I'm so happy that you called in today to share this story. And I think that more and more of this needs to happen around the country. So I definitely I'll be in touch with you, and we definitely would like to do a follow-up with you sometime here in the future.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Our pleasure. Take care. Okay, that was Sarah Morgan from Tacoma, Washington. And, man, this just dovetails into what we were talking about earlier, Gus and Bob.
I got a little bit of a related story to that.
Okay.
Just recently, here about 10 days ago, the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, put out a new rule. And it says they're pushing for adoption for pay ratio disclosure, and it's going to start in 2018. Actually, Senator Elizabeth Warren was one of the main advocates of this.
Okay.
And they're going to have to compare chief executive's officer compensation with the average worker pay. Of course, Republicans and trade groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce have fought back against the measure at every turn. This was something that was actually put into the Dodd-Frank things when it was adopted in 2010, but it's actually going into effect. And companies are going to have to start reporting this in the first fiscal year beginning on or after January 1st, 2017. Well, of course, one of our favorites comes out in the worst position here. Average worker pay at McDonald's is $11,324 every year.
Oh.
Their CEO makes $7.29 million. The pay gap ratio at McDonald's is 644 times.
Wow.
The CEO makes that times what the average worker makes there. Here's another one on the top 10 list here, J.P. Morgan Chase. The average worker pay there per year is $125,000.
Okay.
J.P. Morgan Chase, yet their chief executive makes $27.7 million, so their ratio is 222 times what their average worker
even at $125,000 a year salary. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And Carmike Cinemas is on the list here too, and their average worker pay, again, like McDonald's, $11,789 a year. You know, but their chief executive makes $3.25 million, so their ratio is 276. So these are all statistics coming from Bloomberg, but it's a little bit of good news, actually, that this is going to be enacted into law and mm-hmm. that they're going to have to actually come out and publish these ratios. And it's astounding, 644 times what the average worker at McDonald's makes.
Yeah, and as far as the United States compared to other countries, we've got we've got the highest disparity between top CEO pay and worker average worker pay and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back.
It's time to wake up and get with the movement. Hear the message in the music now. We could fight back, or we could lay down, or beat back the bank attack and stay proud. They got bailed out, we getting sold out. Some living underwater in their own house. They hear the word foreclosure, they get scared and think it's all over. But nah, the fight just begun. It ain't gonna be easy, but it must be won. Cause Bank of America's bad for America. Congress held hostage, they kidnapped the treasurer. This ain't the dream in the land of America, but we could change that if we stand up together. Demand something better than the status quo. We elect, they neglect, then they have to go. We gon' beat back the bank attack. We gon' beat back that bank attack. We gon' beat back the bank attack. We gon' beat back that bank attack. They said up with the people, yeah. They down with the bank, those greedy banks. Said up with the people, yeah. They down with the bank, those dirty banks.
Yeah, it's capitalism, political arcade. Stop the evictions, we picket and blockade. March and rally for social justice. Forged signatures, got the robo busted. Do the right thing now, reduce the principle.
Okay, we're back listening to World Labor Hour, and that was Twice Thou, their song Bank Attack, a political hip-hop band out of Boston. So, okay, Gus, what else is new in the world here this week?
This past week marked the 50th anniversary of one of the largest political movements in United States history, which is often looked over and often depoliticized in high schools, university classrooms, and in the general public, the Watts Rebellion.
Okay.
Not the Los Angeles Watts Rebellion of 1965, not the Watts Riots, as the people who want to depoliticize a political movement say that they were just doing all this, this spontaneous action and behavior. No, this was a politicized rebellious movement, and I'm actually going to go into the history of it today to talk about the 50th anniversary.
Okay.
And why I'm doing this is because you see a lot of the same issues in terms of political reporting of this, and also media establishment and the general reception of these types of actions that happened in Ferguson, Baltimore, and other issues surrounding police violence. I mean, just look at some of the stuff that they were saying back in the 60s compared to what you hear now in terms of CNN, the big major markets. Los Angeles Revere Police Chief William Parker compared the residents of South Los Angeles back in 1965 to, quote, monkeys in the zoo.
What?
Conservative politician, ideological individual Edward Banfield later described the series of rebellions in 1960 as outbreaks, and this is quoted, outbreaks of animal spirits and of stealing by slum dwellers. And again, I like to point out the contradiction to the people who don't accuse the American Revolution patriots as being people who stole, when in fact they looted often, and they also lynched British supporters and trees and hung them there until their bodies turned to skeletons.
And tar and feathered,
tar and feathered them.
Yeah.
But we don't talk about those kind of things, though, those contradictions. But mind you, so let's talk a little bit about why this is important and what actually happened, because there's a lot of stereotypical ideas about what the Watts Rebellion was and what it was all about. So back on August 11, 1965, it was one of the hottest days in the country. And what happened was, according to the cop who struck the spark that set off the Watts Rebellion, around 6 p.m., Lee Meninkis, a California Highway Patrol motorcycle officer, pulled over 21-year-old Marquette Fry at the intersection of Segundo and Avalon, southwest of Watts neighborhood, and arrested him on charges of drunk driving. So Fry and his brother, Ronald, a passenger in the car, were a few blocks from home when Officer Meninkis pulled them over. Alerted to the arrest, Marquette's mother, Rena Price, came from her house to find her son being manhandled by Meninkis and fellow white police officers that were called to the scene. So Price was shoved from behind and jumped on the back of the cop who was holding Marquette, causing the gathering crowd, because that's what happens in these black neighborhoods, and this is how it used to be back in the 60s and 70s. If you look at the history, whenever cops would go into neighborhoods like this, the whole community would come outside and support the member being harassed by the police.
That doesn't happen now
because of economic conditions that have fractured the black community in neoliberal global capitalism. Mm-hmm. But again, back then, when the policeman walked in, everybody went outside because they wanted to make sure they protected the member of the community. So what ends up happening is that, and this is when things got ahead, one officer hits Marquette in the head with his baton, and all three family members were arrested. Lacine Holland, a county worker who was in the neighborhood to pick up her children after work, remember watching the police take Marquette, and they threw him in the car like a bag of laundry. So that's when the crowd really, really started getting bigger. Tensions continued to rise, and then after the police car drove away, Holland watched as a cop who had been spit at by someone in the crowd grabbed a woman at random from among the onlookers and yanked her so strong that her hair rollers fell out. So as the sun set and word about the arrest and brutality spread through the neighborhood, more people came out from surrounding neighborhoods. Police cars that ventured into the area were met by a hail of stone and bricks. So were vehicles driven by white drivers. The next target for angry residents, again, by when we say target, we're already talking about political movement here, because by target, I mean that I'm looking for something. There's an objective to what I'm doing. I'm not doing it spontaneously. I'm actually targeting something. The next target was for white-owned businesses. Watts was part of the South Los Angeles area that had become the only housing option for the large migration of black people to the city. So after the Second World War, an estimated 95% of Los Angeles housing
was off limits to black people and also to Asians due to a system of restrictive housing covenants that enforced de facto segregation even after the covenants were declared illegal. Huh. They still enforced them no matter what. So you could not, if you were black, you could not move into 95% of the housing in those areas. The state legislature passed the Rumford Fair Housing Act of 1963 to try to end racist discrimination against renters and home buyers. But the real estate industry, those corporations and capitalists, mobilized the next year to win the passage thanks to a majority of white voters of Proposition 14, which overturned that law. So again, segregation is law. Blacks in South Los Angeles endured substandard schools, hospitals, and other services, and industrial jobs were drying up, especially in 65 when the recession was getting ready to hit. But the stores and businesses of the area remained white-owned. So this whole idea of looking at Ferguson and Baltimore, when all you heard were people from black middle class especially who were talking down to these rebels, and also the white media saying they're burning their own stuff, they're hurting their own stuff. We don't own anything in our communities because of laws like this and because of racist discrimination against people, so we don't have access to own these things. That's why it's important that we put it into context what a rebellion actually is. It is not a riot. It is a political movement. And just to give just another take on this from somebody who's there, Betty Pleasant, who in 1965 was a young journalist for the Los Angeles Sentinel, the city's main black newspaper, pointed out in an interview that there were still a lot of stores and businesses in the area at the time, but as far as the residents were concerned, they were white-owned stores selling substandard stuff for high prices. Here's what she said. Pleasant described watching a crowd as it moved to the big supermarket on 103rd Street that was notorious for selling awful food specifically for black people, because that was their main demographic who shopped there. So they sold awful food there on purpose. Several months before, Pleasant says that she covered a demonstration where people were trying to get them to sell better meat, better baked goods, and better produce, because remember, our health is very important to us. They burned it down. I don't think they even bothered to loot that sucker. They were so angry that there was nothing. We don't want to take what you have in there. We want to show that we are upset and we will not take this lower position in society by you selling us bad meat. That's a human rights violation, and we're going to burn it down to prove our point. On the corner of 92nd and Wilmington was a very small, tiny grocery store owned by an elderly black couple. Their store was untouched because word went around not to touch this one because it was black owned. So how can people call this a riot when they actually drew out plans on where they were going to go, what they were going to attack, and what type of statement they were trying to make? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened in Ferguson, and that's especially what happened during the Baltimore rebellions of the earlier this year. There was actual movement towards where they were going, what they were targeting. It was not spontaneous. Clearly, the target of the quote-unquote rioters wasn't general mayhem, but the very specific symbols of the neighborhood's grievances. And this is where it goes down to, we have to stop looking at this from a superficial standpoint of strictly black versus white. It's about police and property. We have to look at that from the political economy of the country, where people are being disadvantaged because of distribution of wealth based on global neoliberal capitalism. And of course, the group that falls on the sword more than any other group because of our history of slavery and repression are African Americans. And that's why rebellions happen to this day. And that's what Baltimore and Ferguson, even though they were sparked by police violence. I mean, it was a spark. The cause was a foundational distrust and anger at the repression and lack of resources to do anything to break the status quo in America. And that's what the rebellions were all about. So just to finish up on a very strong point, the following week after the unrest and had mostly calmed down, Martin Luther King toured Watts along with activist Dick Gregory, who was also a famous comedian. Their message of nonviolence and de-escalation didn't go down very well. Gregory was shot in the leg by a sniper. When he used the police bullhorn to urge the people to stay off the streets. In talking to King, one youth summed up the message of the Watts Rebellion: we won because we make them pay attention. And again, that is a historical trend in America. When disruption happens and people challenge the system in these types of rebellions, there's always an immediate progress for that particular area. And that's what happened in Los Angeles. After so many years of the conditions for blacks in northern cities being ignored, even as the attention of the world was focused on the Jim Crow South, because everybody, of course, there's racism all over the country, but Jim Crow South had an especially really nasty, virulent racism. Mm-hmm. This was an achievement in itself. But Watts made the political and business elite of America do more than just pay attention. After this one, there were many more urban rebellions to come in the next three summers because rebellion is infectious. After Watts, including the one in 1967 Detroit, you had him in Atlanta, you had him in Newark, New Jersey, a bunch of different places. And again, we're looking at this from the standpoint of what's going on today in 2015 as police repression continues. I mean, we're now over 500, and I think the number actually after last week has gone up to over 600 people, regardless of color, that have been killed by police.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's getting to that point now. Why is the repression increasing as the movement to stop police violence is increasing? There's something weird we have to examine there, and that's because in terms of, and you can ask the neoliberal theorists, they'll tell you this is what they do. And to continue this type of repression and economic sanctions against people of color, we have to repress them, because when they start to rise up, like Black Lives Matter and other community organizations, they are damaging and threatening neoliberal global capitalism. They are doing that. We have to repress them. And that's why as more democratic movements against police continue, more police repression continues. Because I've noticed that it's a story every day now versus earlier this year when it was a story every week.
Yeah, we were just talking before the show about how, you know, here – it's been more publicized, you know, ever since last year when Michael Brown was killed by Darren Wilson and stuff. And you'd think that the cops would have backed off and all this and that, but it seems like they're actually doing more and more, you know. So this fits into this. It seems like, you know, the ruling class in this country, they've got a plan for us, and they know we're not going to like it. That means that they're going to try to, you know, get rid of our security and then forget about single payer. They're going to cut Medicare completely and privatize it.
Yeah.
There's going to be more wage cuts. There's going to be more austerity. And this is what we're talking about here is austerity. And they know we're not going to like it, and they're willing, you know, they've learned their lessons from history too. And they basically, I think in their opinion, they think FDR backed down. They think that during the 60s, there was too many concessions given. And this time they're not going to back down. They don't care how many people are killed.
Yeah. So now, just to kind of conclude on, because I don't want to just give the history, like, what can we do to move forward?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What is the purpose of this? Because, you know, like I said, the more we actually fight back, the more repression comes. There is a point to where that repression no longer can affect us. The first thing we have to be very careful about is we must not fall into the trap of corporatizing Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that really frightens me as Black Lives Matter continues to grow, especially in the wake of the Bernie Sanders situation that we're going to talk about in a minute, is that it's starting to get a lot of media attention. And whenever media attention gets onto these types of movements, it tends to, you know, water them down and saturate them within the status quo and actually turn them more to the right than they're supposed to go. So that's a very frightening aspect that we have to be careful. And the only way to do that is to make sure that we're strong locally. We have to continue to build our communities up, and that as fractured as they are, it's a very difficult thing to do. But we have to go knock on doors. We have to go tell people and educate them, give them a real political education. I get that from Sundiata Chajua. Mm-hmm. This idea of politically education. It's not about who's running for office. It's about understanding that we exist in a political society to where our rights are being judged. Natural, human, civil rights, regardless, we are political entities, and we have to understand our position in the society. So educating the communities to go past, not just, again, Black Lives Matter are doing great things, but we have to go, also build up our communities outside of the national movements and make local movements just as strong. And that way repression is going to have to take a seat back. When the people continue to get, when the movements get bigger, the repression cannot handle such swells of people. Swelling of people.
That's a good point. Yeah, so Bernie Sanders, I mean, he was speaking in Seattle, and a couple of women got up on the stage and basically got control of the microphone from Black Lives Matter movement. You know, when this first happened, Gus, I'm going to be honest with you, I didn't know what to make of it at very first. I thought perhaps that, I didn't know, for instance, that these women really were from the Black Lives Matter movement. And second of all, I thought it might have been a dirty trick by the Hillary Clinton campaign or something, you know. But it turns out after about a day or so, I started seeing things coming across the internet, shown that yes, they were indeed from Black Lives Matter. And there was two things that they said that I thought was interesting. One was that they did it to Sanders and not Hillary Clinton, because one, Hillary Clinton had massive security. Yeah. And two, that they thought Sanders would be more, receptive than Hillary Clinton.
Right. And this is exactly what I was talking about last week. This is probably one of the greatest stories I've heard in a long time, because it's what I've been telling people and just been really advocating for. We cannot allow the Democratic or Republican nominees to give us a platform. We have to go to where they are and we have to make them talk about the things that we care about. Otherwise, they're going to just give us a prepackaged, superficial thing that we don't care about. The focus on Sanders by the Black Lives Matter activists has really worked. He is actually now starting to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to do. That is a historical trend. When we force the politicians to become public servants again and not be politicians, then they can actually do some good and we can have some real discussion about where this country can go forward. That's what they were doing. And just to give you some data here, since his first encounter with Black Lives Matter activists, Sanders has sharpened his racial justice platform to include demilitarizing the police, which he refused to talk about before the Black Lives Matter protest, decriminalizing marijuana, which he did talk about somewhat, but now he's being very forward with it, and investing $5 billion, quote, to employ young people of color. Now, I'm a bit skeptical about that, because usually when the government says people of color, that doesn't necessarily mean African Americans. They use that term to kind of get around that, so I'm going to watch him on that. But he has also hired a new Black National Press Secretary, Simone Sanders, to help him communicate more effectively with Black voters, and she was a member of Black Lives Matter. So after the event happened, he actually took somebody from Black Lives Matter and put her into his campaign. So again, this stuff actually is working. But the thing is that it can't be here. It can't just be presidential nominations, even though that's important. We have to do this locally, and we especially have to do this with the state government officials who have been the most racist in history and have been the most contributors to capitalism in this country, further continuing economic disparities. So this is a very important historical trend that we really need to study and possibly expand.
Yeah, and direct actions get the goods, right?
It's historical.
Yes, indeed. And anything else before we go?
That's it. And just like I said, remember to really talk about these things. You know, this is like the third time we've done an anniversary topic recently, but these things are important.
Oh, indeed.
All the stuff that's happening in history is really starting to come forward now, because we're at a very pivotal moment where things are changing politically, economically, socially, culturally. I mean, it's happening now. So we have to continue to talk about these things and really put them in the context and break them down to what we can do moving forward. And I think that the stuff going on with Bernie Sanders and the Black Lives Matter and just about building communities up and finding out how to break this economic disparity, I think it's going to put us in the right place. I have faith in the people to do these things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bob?
I got a quick public service announcement,
okay.
I guess.
All right.
American Legion Post 559 is having a Summerfest 2015 this afternoon in the parking lot up there. That's located at 704 North Hickory Street.
Oh, yes.
Five blues bands going to be playing there.
Wow.
Gates open at 3. Candy Foster and Shades of Blue play at 4.
Okay.
Several other local bands, Recca Store and Kilbourne Alley. And then a band out of Decatur, Men of Essence, and then a band out of Indianapolis, Car Jam, is playing.
Okay.
So there's a small admission charge. They advise you to bring your lawn chairs so you can sit down close to the stage. And the Legion's going to have food and beverages available for people, and part of the proceeds go to benefit back-to-school supplies for kids and stuff like that.
Oh, great,
Starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon at the American Legion Post 559, 704 North Hickory. So there's a good thing to come out. And that's for our buddy Jim Iman, who called earlier and was talking about lack of Black involvement in blues and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And here's a blues fest getting put on by the American Legion here and featuring some great African-American artists.
Great. And Gus, isn't there an event coming up here that was talked about, the Jobs with Justice meeting that Brian Dolner had mentioned?
On August, I believe it's going to be August 30th.
Okay.
But
okay.
Don't quote, listeners, I do apologize. I don't know.
We got some time on this, so maybe okay, we'll get some more information on this.
It's definitely going to be either the 30th or the 31st.
Okay.
And there's going to be this great, art piece that's going on at the IMC that's going to involve a lot of spoken word, a lot of poetry, mm-hmm. Some musical pieces as well. We have some great local artists that are doing amazing work out here in Champaign-Urbana okay. that are going to be performing, and we'll have more information next weekend
sure.
on the show for that. I'll have the actual date and the different list of people who are going to perform, things like that. So we'll mention that. But just be on the lookout for that. It's going to be an amazing piece.
Okay. Yeah, there's a WEFT benefit going on actually on Monday the 31st.
Oh, yeah.
At the Iron Post.
So, oh, okay.
You know, we'll get yeah. you the information on the thing at the IMC and bring you more information about both those events next yeah. week.
Okay, very good. Great. Okay, excellent. So you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on the Supporting Community Radio Station, WT in Champaign. And until next week, be safe and power the people. Take care.